Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Our weekly conversations include you. If you'd like to join us, our phone number is 941-3689, 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, use that number. And from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream, it's 877-941-3689. Talking about race on a good day isn't easy for most people. And especially since this summer, racial talk hasn't had many good days. The events in Ferguson, Staten Island, and Cleveland have spawned outrage online, on air, and on the streets. But has all that talk conflated the cases, the circumstances, and the anger, obscuring actual facts and judgments? A USA Pew Research poll released 10 days ago seems to suggest not. Tonight, we're going to take another run at a difficult conversation, race and justice in America and in Hawaii. Few of us want to imagine that we may hold some deep-seated prejudice, but the study now underway seeks to measure just how much unconscious, implicit bias we may suffer from. It's a project of UH Law Professor Justin Levinson. He teaches law and is the founding director of the Culture and Jury Project at the University of Hawaii's William S. Richardson School of Law. Professor Levinson's research focuses on how the human mind operates in the legal context, and he is the co-editor of Implicit Racial Bias Across the Law. Also joining us tonight is Professor Linda Hamilton Krieger. She is the chair of the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission and a professor of law at the University of Hawaii William S. Richardson School of Law. She's written extensively on anti-discrimination law and policy and on legal decision-making, and has been a visiting professor at the Harvard Law School and the French Political Science Institute in Paris. And, of course, you're here, too. Again, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks, Bethany.
Now, this isn't an easy conversation. We started to have it, Justin Levinson, about 10 days ago when that study first came out, and we talked a little bit about that, how people were processing the various different ways of not only just what had happened with grand juries, but the ways in which the anger and upset over those grand jury decisions were being put out on social media, in the media, and just in corner conversations. In the 10 days since, has there been anything that you have seen that has mitigated any of what we talked about 10 days ago?
I don't think it's mitigated it. I think seeing the continuation of protests across the country, including local events in Hawaii, has tried to keep alive the message that this is an important topic and not something that a lot of people are willing to stand for.
But people clearly had to have a different idea of what happened in the case with Michael Brown versus what happened with Eric Garner. There were different ways in which people were judging that. After the initial brouhaha over each, was there a strain of the conversation that you saw that began to tell a little bit different story, something more of what was measured in that Pew research that we saw 10
days
ago?
Yeah, so the research that you're talking about showed that white Americans tended to think that the Michael Brown outcome is the correct outcome, and that was not the case for the Eric Garner situation. I think the video is the difference. I personally think that if there was a video of the Michael Brown situation, that, you know, people would be outraged with it as well. That's just my personal opinion. I think the way Michael Brown was portrayed in a lot of ways was very consistent with racial stereotypes that have been documented for a long time now. And I think that allowed people to imagine him in a certain way that made the police officer's actions seem more legitimate.
When we talk about those two cases, they seem to be, each of them, in a different category. And then you have the situation with Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old who was shot in Cleveland. How does that play into it when we have a 12-year-old who's playing with ostensibly a toy, but then winds up in the same position as the other two?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the same set of stereotypes that African-American men are stereotyped as being aggressive and violent. There's study after study that documents this. And Tamir Rice, even though he was only 12, probably was big enough to trigger that stereotype. And so he paid for it with his life.
But when you look at a picture of him, he seems to look so young, like what you or I might look at as being a child. Have we?
He was a child.
Right. I mean, when we to look at him to say, well, there is a child. That's not somebody who might be particularly threatening to someone. How do you start to disentangle that huge idea of, well, this is the stereotype?
Well, I mean, the research can focus on that exact question if you wanted it to, right? When does the stereotype start? How does it emerge? Does the stereotype exist for 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds? You know, the gun weapon stereotype probably does not apply to young children, but, you know, I would suspect that a 12-year-old boy holding what appears to be a gun would fit within the aggressive stereotype of African Americans.
Yeah, I'd like to suggest
Linda Krieger, come into this.
Yeah, I'd like to suggest that the stereotyping begins earlier than we would think. Most people are familiar with the recent research on implicit stereotypes explored in things like the implicit association test or the shooter bias studies that show that police officers and others will react more quickly to make a decision to shoot when they think that an African-American male is holding something that looks like a gun than if a white male is holding the same object. So there, this research a lot of people know about. Fewer people know about much earlier research that was done in the 1970s, 60s and 70s, that came out of efforts to understand some of the dynamics that were happening around school desegregation after Brown versus Board of Education. There's one study in particular that was done at Berkeley that showed children in an elementary school. These were second and third grade children. And it was the same vignette. In one condition, there was an African-American little boy who was poking the student in front of him with his pencil, the eraser side of his pencil. And in another condition, the same gesture was being made by a little white boy. And students were asked to characterize the behavior. And when the African-American boy was doing the poking, the activity was described as hostile or as aggressive. And when the white student was doing the activity, it was more likely to be characterized as teasing or playing around. So even as early as second and third grade, these stereotypes are already in place.
Is there any way to get around some of that now at that early stage? I mean, this seems that if it is happening that early and from that study and others that you've mentioned, it seems that it is. Are we then looking for a solution too late, where we should be looking for something happening much, much younger when children are in preschool?
Yeah, I think that we are one of the problems with public policy around race relations in this country at this time is that we're looking for quick fixes, right? We're looking for some simplistic kind of magic bullet that we could use that will change everything. But categories don't work that way, right? Racial categories are categories, just like any other categories. Chair, bird, bug, whatever, right? And people use the categories that they use because they help them make sense of their physical and social environment. And the content of those categories, right, what the categories comprise depends on what people perceive, either in their own lives or in their virtual lives, right, watching movies, reading books, reading newspapers, watching TV news. And unless we change what people are seeing and hearing about racial groups, we can't expect them not to have certain schematic biases about how members of those groups are likely to behave, how they have behaved in the past, how they will behave in the future, how their ambiguous behaviors get characterized, right? So we really have to look at our culture. I remember when I was a younger lawyer and working in San Francisco, there was a lot of activity protesting movies that contained racist or sexist content. I mean, there were literally situations where movies were shut down because of the stereotyping that was being portrayed in those movies. You don't see that anymore. I mean, you really don't see people taking strong political stances against the depiction of groups in stereotyped ways.
Or even the way in which they're being named. Clearly in the 80s there was such a movement to say African-American, not to say black. And some people, you know, chided that whole scenario as being far too PC for our own good. And why can't we just call someone, you know, what a preferred term may be if someone prefers whatever it may be, as opposed to having to sanitize it in some way?
Right. And the very expression PC during the 1980s started being used as sort of an epithet, a way of making fun of or delegitimating people who are really trying to debias the culture. And it worked. I mean, to the point that now being told you're being too PC tends to silence you, right? It's not something people like to be called.
So how do we extract that to both of you as we're trying to look at teaching kids, because we're really talking about how do we move this into a much younger generation, because it's not going to just be one set of policies that deal with older kids, teens, and young adults, but especially for young children, to make it so it isn't so politically correct in that pejorative sense, but to make it understandable for a child, and also to sort of desensitize that sting around being PC by being able to use correct terminology.
Yeah. Before we get into the question of how to solve it at the children's age, I just wanted to point out the connection between the research Linda's talking about and schools, right? We started by talking about criminal justice. And one of the things about implicit bias is that while I think we could spend a whole hour, a whole day, a whole week talking about race, ethnicity, and criminal justice, it's not just about that, right? So think about schools. How are decisions made to discipline children? It all goes back to the kind of research that Linda was talking about, and the studies bear that out. So there's what people call the school-to-prison pipeline, that members of minority communities are stereotyped in a certain way. Their aggressive behaviors are perceived consistently with that. They're suspended, and basically they're taught that they're not part of a system, and they're eventually, you know, they end up in jail as adults. And so I want to make sure not to limit ourselves to the conversation of race in the criminal justice system. It is about the education system. It is about the healthcare system. It is about housing systems. So it's a broader conversation, and I think we should welcome dialogue in all of those areas.
Well, because you're talking about justice in the broadest sense in terms of social justice and understanding that it's more than just a set of laws.
Yeah, I think we're talking about really fundamental societal principles,
change.
Right? Yeah, change, but it's just about fairness, right? We're not trying to upset something just for the sake of upsetting a system. What we're trying to do is have a fair society where everybody gets a fair shake and doesn't get pushed down a certain path because of how they're perceived.
50, 60 years ago, there was a generation that was trying to make that point and that was assuring the younger children coming up that this wasn't going to be an issue when you get older. And yet, very clearly, as we've seen with a great many things, including, you know, pay equity and other issues that keep rebounding and resurging, that in some ways we haven't come very far. How do you look at that journey from the civil rights movement until now?
My own view, having been involved in doing civil rights legal work for my entire career, is that we were making very good progress in the 60s and 70s and into the beginning of the 80s. I really think we were making significant strides. And this is part of the reason why so many women are in the careers they have now, myself included, you included, and why there is a black middle class at this time. But I fear that starting in the early to mid-80s, as a country, we started going backwards with the attacks on affirmative action programs, attacks on structural thinking about equality, things that in the legal sphere, and I'm going to use a legal term here, it's called disparate impact theory. It's one of the legal doctrines that developed under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that basically holds the principle that if you have a selection device, a test, a height requirement, a weight requirement that has a disparate impact on a subordinated group that's protected by Title VII, unless that can shown be shown to be necessary to the safe and efficient conduct of the business, it is discriminatory, is illegal, and must be stopped, right? So this idea that racism, sexism can be structural. It's not just a question of a badly motivated individual actor. It's actually built into our institutionalized practices. That idea had been making quite a big bit of headway, and right in the middle of the 80s, it sort of fell off a legal cliff.
Why? What caused it to happen? I mean, can you trace it to anything in
yes,
particular?
I trace it to the Reagan Justice Department, and in particular to William Bradford Reynolds, who was the head of the Civil Rights Division of the Reagan Justice Department. This is at the same time that Clarence Thomas became the chairman of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And the policies that were pursued in the 80s squarely targeted affirmative action programs and disparate impact theories of discrimination and statistical proof of discrimination that was used in class actions. And it took a couple of decades for that agenda to really succeed, but it has succeeded. So the Civil Rights Act of 1964 now is not a particularly effective way of combating racial inequality or gender inequality. It once was. And we made a lot of progress when, as a society, we decided that we were going to make that progress. I think we are really at a point now where we have to decide, as a polity, as a collectivity, whether we are really committed to racial equality and racial justice.
How much evidence do you see in that, Justin Levinson, and how do you see some of the research that you're starting to do now helping to support the evidence that all of us maybe need to take a look at to get to the point where Linda Krieger says we might want to go?
The evidence is strong, Bethann, that we have a whole range of biases that we carry with us on a daily basis that affect the way we perceive the world and make decisions and act. And I'm running a study in Hawaii right now, not just focused on the traditional national lens of bias, but focused on how we perceive different groups within Hawaii. So we're talking about different communities in Hawaii that have had various plights, some successful, some less successful, and how they're perceived on an implicit level.
Which groups?
So in the first study, I'm looking at the Native Hawaiian community, the Micronesian community, and also Japanese Americans and Caucasians. And that's just because of limited time and resources for an initial study. But of course, there are other groups that I think we ought to look at.
How are you proceeding with this study that's different from the work that you've done previously?
Well, some of the methods are the same. So I use implicit measures such as the implicit association test, reaction time, quote, games, essentially. And we measure how people associate different concepts with positive and negative attitudes and stereotypes. So how fast can you group together? A traditional example would be male, female, and the home and the workplace. How fast can people group together female names or male names with, you know, words like salary and career versus, you know, children and home? And basically what you can find is that people associate certain concepts much, much more quickly than others. And that predicts how they act and make decisions in varying circumstances. So in this case, we're just applying the same time-tested methods to a local context. So how do people stereotype Micronesians? For example, are they stereotyped as aggressive or as lazy, or are they stereotyped more positively? And this could help explain, for example, the disproportionate incarceration of Micronesians or maybe Native Hawaiians and other groups in Hawaii.
I want to have you give us an example just in a moment, and just to let you know that we're going to be taking callers. We've got some folks waiting on the line. I promise we'll get to you in just a second. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Can you give me an example when you say that, you know, certain words, certain associations, walk us through that just a little bit of how those concepts tell you what someone's implicit bias may be?
Right. So a very simple way to think about it, some of the initial tests you can think about, for example, how do people think about bugs versus flowers, right? people, and then you have them sort together either pictures of bugs and flowers or words related to bugs and flowers with positive or negative concepts like joy, happiness, you know, awful, shame. And essentially you have a computer game where you have you ask people to sort words together. So if you're required to sort together pictures of flowers with words like joy and happiness, people can do that much faster than they can sort together pictures of bugs with words joy and happiness. And on the flip side of that, people can sort bug words with negative concepts like awful and scary.
Okay, but how does that translate into having a bias against fill in the blank?
Right. So then when you start applying it to certain groups, okay, whether it's racial groups, gender groups, you can look not only at attitudes, how we implicitly feel towards a group, positive or negative, but you can look at specific stereotypes. So you can use words such as lazy and aggressive, and you can measure response times. And if people are quick to group together a specific group with lazy or aggressive, or a specific group, you know, with successful and hardworking, that tells you something about what's going on in the human mind.
All right. We're going to leave it there for a second and start taking some of your calls. Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you call us from the Neighbor Islands or if you're listening to the live stream. We're talking about racial bias and how it's implicit and unconscious activity of maybe telling us more about ourselves and where we need to go as a society than perhaps it has in past. How do you feel about knowing that you might be carrying around some implicit biases that you may be applying, whether you know it or not? We want to hear from you, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the big question is, are we as a society going to look at this more carefully and decide where we want to go? Are we ready to have that national conversation? Do you think perhaps we're already having it? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Matt, calling us from Haleiwa. Aloha, Matt. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, how are we doing?
Doing well, thanks.
My comment slash question is, first of all, about the Sanford prison experiment, to where students were put in, like, behind bars, and then there was guards and there's prisoners, but then they started unconsciously acting in a certain way, to where I'm just seeing, as far as like military vehicles being given to police places or whatever, to where every bias comes to me directly from the environment. You know, you have a bias against the prison guard, you know, when you are a prisoner, and because of your environment and where that comes from. So people are becoming more and more in the environment of, I believe, that's where I'm trying to come from. So, but thank you. I'll go off the air now. Aloha.
All right. Thanks very much, Matt,
okay,
for your call.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Matt, this is it's wonderful to hear you mention the prison experiment. And I think one of the lessons that study teaches is that people's behavior is often shaped by what we might call implicit norms, right? That the structure of a situation tells us how to behave. And even without thinking of ourselves as the kind of people who would behave in a particular way, we find that, well, we do, when the cues in the environment are such that they lead us down that path. And so I think one of the things that's important here is to look at how situations can prime behavior. And I think that the point about the militarization of the police is a very good point, that arming police officers with military-style equipment primes a set of norms about war, about battles, about enemies. And it will, I'm not saying that it directly will cause the kind of behavior that we sometimes see, but it certainly facilitates that kind of behavior, that kind of response.
Certainly, if you're given all of that equipment, it would be a natural thing, both consciously and perhaps unconsciously, to think, okay, I must have this equipment for a reason.
That's right.
Therefore, I must use it.
I have military equipment that must make me a soldier, that must make this an army, that must mean I have an enemy. Who's the enemy? The black community is the enemy, right? And so people start behaving that way.
All right, we've got lots of callers on the line. Justin, did you want to say anything?
Just one quick thing. I want to thank Matt for calling and also connect the environmental topic that he mentioned back to our earlier discussion about children, right? And we haven't yet answered the question about how do we create an environment where children are going to learn.
I'm going to make you answer that one in just a little
bit. But I think this particular comment brings up the issue of how do we treat our own infants, our own toddlers, when they're around other kids from different groups? Do we pull them back a little bit quicker? Or do we not? So we do have a sense of responsibility for the environment, starting with the beginning of life, really.
All right. We're going to talk more about that as we continue to take a look at racial biases that may be implicit, unconscious, and clearly necessary for us to cope with and grapple with if, as my guest say tonight, were to move society into a place that they believe we were over 50 years ago. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going now to Anita calling us from Waipahu. Aloha, Anita. Welcome to Town Square.
Yes, good afternoon. I noticed one commentator was saying how in the 60s we were all going to get better and things were going to be different. I remember that. I resemble that. But I want to give people an uplifting idea that things maybe are going back to that. I'm a volunteer with a project called History Day. It's a national competition for intermediate and high school students to do historic research, and they, like science fair, they have various competitions. And as a judge, you meet with the students and talk to them. And these are young teens, and universally, they have found injustice. And it is never going to happen again because they are going to be in charge in the future. Mm-hmm. And they're going to not allow these things to happen. And they truly seem to see people differently. It's amazing to them that a Chinese girl would have been locked in her room by her mother because she wanted to date a Japanese boy. And that was a Hawaii story. And you can see it in their face and their tone. They don't see this as a reasonable option that they would ever allow to happen. So I do think it maybe can get better, and we should have some faith in the young people to do things differently.
Anita, thanks very much for the hopeful call. We appreciate that. And good luck with History Day. Going now to Trevor calling us from Pearl City. Aloha, Trevor. Welcome to Town Square. And before we get to you for a second, just to remind you, if you would like to join us, our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you're calling us from the neighbor islands or listening to the live stream. Talking about race tonight, a conversation that most people find difficult to have. Even on the best of days, we've had a lot of days that have been not the best of days. They've been some of the worst. And does it mean that we can have an honest conversation about how we regard each other? Some of the research that we're talking about that's going on here in Hawaii, to take a look at that, and some of the research that's been happening for decades. We're talking to you tonight if you want to give us a call and be part of the conversation. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Hello, Trevor. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you.
I think that the conversation needs to be, at least in Hawaii, in terms of race, needs to be framed in the context of the plantation era. I mean, we've sort of inherited these silos, the Japanese camp, the Filipino camp, the Korean and Chinese, and that has been extrapolated, and we really haven't grown out of that model. Even just alone on Oahu, individual communities, Japanese, Pearl City, Filipino, Waipahu, we live in these insular communities that, yes, we do get together and have potlucks, but for the most part, we stay within our ethnic groups. I'm sure that's changed within the last 10, 15 years with Hapa kids. I'm Hapa. Most of my friends are Hapa. But I think the older generation is still sort of mono-ethnic.
And the split that you're talking about is very clear in a lot of kids that we see who are straddling those fences of being in two different cultures. How has that been for you? Have you felt that you belong to both or belong to neither or somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, so I'm half Filipino, part Japanese, and part Maoli as well, and I've never really felt like I fit anywhere. I didn't necessarily grow up eating dinuguan, didn't necessarily grow up pounding mochi, and didn't really eat sauerkraut growing up either, despite being part German. So I would say, no, I would identify as someone who's local.
Trevor, as difficult as that might be for you, having that feeling that you don't really belong to any particular group, some people might argue that you're a hybrid that a lot of other people would like to imitate. How does that strike you?
Good, I guess. It feels good. I mean, a hybrid, I'm not sure I understand why anybody would want to imitate that.
From the sense that because you straddle so many different ethnicities or several different ethnicities, that you have a distinct perspective that allows you to see beyond each individual one and to see some of the beauty in all.
Sure. I'd agree.
All right. Well, thanks very much for your call. Good to hear from you.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. If you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We're talking about race, and you couldn't go many places over the last 6 months without hearing something about race online, on the air, or on the streets of many cities. As we try to confront some of the issues that are coming back at us again, that my guests say were some of the issues that we tried to grapple with over 50 years ago, have we really done any better at being able to figure out those implicit biases and how we want to move society beyond those? If that's possible, what do you think? 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. How do you handle those biases that come up? And you know it in your gut when those happen. How do you handle it as someone who lives in Hawaii? Justin Levinson, we often talk about being in Hawaii is such a wonderful place to be because we rub shoulders, we share food, it's a tiny place, we have to get along. But what Trevor just said is that, yeah, that's sort of the mythology of it to a point, but we still live in little silos, and there's still a lot of angst over being able to mix too much.
Yeah, I think with every success comes a challenge, right? So Trevor's experience is an interesting one. It's something that people talk a lot about. My students talk about it. And I think the first thing we need to do is validate the experience. And every generation here has a different experience for a variety of reasons. I think looking back at the plantation era and more broadly, looking at historical responsibility for economic and racial differences is important in Hawaii and on the mainland as well.
And we haven't even begun to layer over some other issues that could be brought into that of religion and orientation and all the other things that we try to cope with and talk about here. Those are maybe conversations for another day. But right now we want to hear from you, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And tonight we're talking about race and some research that's going on here in Hawaii and certainly what we've all seen happen over the last 6 months that brought issues of race squarely in front of us. Whether you wanted to see it or not, it was everywhere. Going now to Carlos, calling us from Kamuela. Aloha. Okay, sorry, Carlos. It appears we've lost you. Sherry from Maui.
Aloha, yes. I just wanted to say just two things. I feel very strongly that to have change, we're going to have to find it from within each individual first. That individual has to find a way in their heart to see each other individual outside of them in a loving way. And if they can't find that or from their family or they're possibly not born with that loving heart, then I think it's imperative that we have education in whether it's the school, definitely the schools. However the child is informed with their society, they need to be taught how to see this way, to see each of us individually, no matter what our race, our color. And as that one gentleman was saying, you know, a lot of us are born into a melting pot. We have a lot of blood, different bloods running through our veins, and that's right there is proof that we're just all a part of a big family here on this earth, and we just need to see each other that way. So education, I think, if you don't have it in your heart and you're not getting it from your family, you can't see it, you can't find it, you're not born with that, then education could help.
Thanks very much for the call. I think that Professor Krieger would like to answer you.
I want to go back to some of this research that was done having to do with school desegregation in the late 60s and 70s. We see from this body of research that there are certain things that do make a difference in terms of how children and adults, but especially children, start relating to members of other groups and attitudes towards members of other groups. And there are four characteristics of an environment that tend to conduce towards better intergroup relations and less prejudice, less discrimination. And those are contact between groups, members of different groups. Secondly, interdependence. So it's not enough to just have contact with members of other groups. You have to be in situations with individual members of those groups where you're interdependent, you know, on each other for your outcomes. Third, the ability to individuate members of the other group so that, you know, one doesn't continue to feel that all X's are alike. And then fourth, and this is the one that I think in Hawaii we really are good at, and that is the creation of groups that have cross-cutting category boundaries. So the worst situation is if people are segregated in terms of residential segregation, school segregation, religious community segregation, right? It's much better for intergroup relations if these different categories are mixed up. And I think there are a lot of institutional practices in Hawaii that are very good at this. I think about my canoe club. I'm a member of Huinalu Canoe Club, and this is everybody, right? It's members of so many different kind of groups, different schools, different neighborhoods, different races. I mean, and these kinds of institutions are part of what I think makes Hawaii so special. I think we have an opportunity here to do that, which hasn't been done in many places.
Part of what I also hear you say is that this comes down to being able to see yourself in somebody else, and how you identify with that goes beyond just intellectual reasons why someone may be similar to you, but to really feel that sense of yourself in someone else.
Absolutely. I mean, the experience of we are in the same canoe.
Literally. Okay. Literally. Well, this canoe is going forward, and we've got a little bit more time to be able to talk, and we're glad to have you join us. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Diana calling from Kona. Brian from Waipahu is on the line.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My problem with race is, like, for example, Hawaii, we're not much exposed to the African-American community because, of, you know, they're only 1% of the population. But the exposure we have is either on TV or on music. And some of the music that these youngins are listening to is like, well, you know, you're not going to repeat that when the African-American guy is around. Or the news we're watching where there's, right, it's all bad. But as I recall, there's news stories about a 15-year-old girl, African-American, being shot at her own community by members of their own community. And they wouldn't, well, they no one knew who shot them, but that's only because they're too afraid to testify. Now, how are we supposed to perceive that? And then saying that, okay, you understand why there are sometimes we look at things as like, what's going on across the continent? Like, you're confusing us here. I mean, there's no violence within your community, or there's nothing negative to say about your community when we're watching it from the outside looking in. I mean, what's with the music and all that negative stuff that they're portraying, and then, like, you know, we buying it, and what?
Brian, I think you made your point well, that part of what we see on the outside is a different viewpoint than what someone may be experiencing on the inside. And also, if you're kind of in that inside group, there may be things that you will say to each other or say as part of a group that you wouldn't want somebody else saying about you, or that you wouldn't allow someone else to say about you too. When we look at that view of the media and what we see in popular culture from, you know, music and movies and TV and some things that go from maybe being as some would say as ridiculous as watching a new TV show that's been out this fall, Blackish, to hearing some of the music comes in, that bothers a lot of people because it feels like it's cartoonish. And then that may be on the more benign side of things, but on the not so benign side of things, some of the music that comes out that doesn't feel very, you know, warm or welcoming, and in fact is anything but. How does that begin to thwart changing how, well, perhaps we view different ethnic groups, particularly the Black community?
So Brian's comment was quite interesting. I think the first thing I'd like to do is acknowledge that there are a lot of studies that focus on the media's role in transmitting bias, that we do as a community learn about different groups and how they operate based upon our contact with the news media, particularly when we don't have contact with those groups. So I think Brian's right to point to the media. I would separate for a moment the TV exposure, such as the news broadcasts, and music culture, which may be generated from within a community, as being different. The TV news context has been shown repeatedly to be probably unintentionally biased in the way that certain groups, including African Americans, are portrayed. And I would hazard a guess that if we took all the local news coverage in Hawaii and looked at how different groups are portrayed here, we would find similar biases towards, for example, Micronesian men and aggressive actions. The music, on the other hand, is also interesting. But I think when you look at a group and you hear music coming out of a certain community that you're not a member of, I think you have to recognize that it comes within a certain cultural and historical context. So drawing back upon some of the previous caller's comments, that this really is within a cultural and historical context, that we can't let that fuel our stereotypes because we're not part of that community and we can't understand that structural piece. But I would also say that Brian's right in the scientific sense that if you play a rap music song or a violent rap music song to people, and then you have them go out and operate in the world, make decisions, it's been shown that simply playing a rap music song for a number of seconds makes people judge African Americans in biased, aggressive ways. So I think there are real dangers to the way that we're exposed to media.
All right, we're going to take some more of your calls now. If you'd like to join us, still a couple lines that may have your name on them. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 is tonight. We're taking a look at race, not just because of what has happened in Ferguson and Staten Island and Cleveland and well beyond in all of the cities that have been staging protests, but also right here in Hawaii. It's a difficult conversation we have now and again. Some new research that Professor Levinson is running to see what kind of implicit bias we may have towards certain groups. We'll be talking about that once some of that research is completed. But for the moment, we want to hear how you feel about the biases that you may know that you have or that you see at large and how that affects our community, both within Hawaii and the greater community throughout the United States. 941-3689 is our number, or 877-941-3689. Going to Bill, calling from Honolulu. Aloha, Bill.
Hey, Aloha. Nice to talk to everybody. Just a couple of observations. It seems like a lot of folks that want to stoke this are interested. They want to be offended. It's almost as if they're looking for excuses to be upset, as opposed to just perhaps maybe trying to figure out there's only one race. Would you come right down to the human race? So the subsets that are doing all this thing, it just seems like it's a desire to be offended. I know, for example, sometimes being completely howly looking, but just without saying a word, if I walk by somebody local who's giving me stink eye at first, just out of suspicion, I look at them and I give them a double eyebrow raise, which is sort of like going, how's it? And all of a sudden it changes from scowl to smile because they realize, hey, this howly is local. So in a perception, a lot of times we look at somebody, they're different, but to me it all boils back down to one race, the human race. Live aloha. Mahalo. I'll listen off the air.
Thanks very much. But that point that he makes, that people find what they want to find, we've seen enough social science coming out to say we look for agreement, that we're hardwired to do that. if you overlay that with the issue of implicit bias, can we get away from that, Justin?
Well, that thing, I mean, first I would have to say I agree with Bill that we should live aloha. But, you know, the interesting thing about his story is that he appears to be Howley, as he said, walking down the street. He gets stink eye, and then he has to show that he's actually part of the in-group by giving a sign, right? So what if Bill wasn't part of the in-group, right? How might he feel? It might be harder, for example, to feel part of the in-group in that
sense.
Well,
we've had other conversations on the show about that where we've had callers say, you know, I'm a local kid, and I've been told to go home. And he says, yeah, I am home. I'm in Kaneohe. I mean, that was another example of what we just heard from Bill, that we look at somebody and clearly judge them by what we see, but we don't, in many cases, stop to think until somebody gives us a sign that, no, they're really part of that group, whether it's the double eyebrow raise or whether it may be simply the way one speaks. And Your point is, what happens if we don't have any of those signs, and what would occur if we didn't do those things? Would we then be looked at simply as being other automatically?
Yeah, I think it's easy to say that, oh, yeah, people are looking for a reason to raise these things when you're part of a privileged group. When you're not part of that privileged group and you're experiencing discrimination, whether it be explicit or implicit, then I think, you know, you feel differently.
All right, we're going to go to Rick calling us from the Windward side. Rick, aloha. Welcome to Town Square.
Yeah, hi. Actually, I'm local Howley, too. I was born in Molokai, and 1952, depression. Anyway, you know, I think the basic problem is economic. It's like this whole, you know, affordable housing thing you guys were talking about this morning. And, you know, it's the same old story my whole life, you know. And it's about economics and about poverty and about enough money to be able to make a living over here. And everybody's getting shoved out. People don't talk about the military subsidy for rental housing that they get $4,000 a month. And then it just ices all the local people out. So, you know, it's economics.
All right, Rick, we're going to talk a little bit about that. And thank you very much for listening this morning. Nice to hear that you were doing that, too. And thank you for joining us now. Economics as a factor in this, but I would take it that you would say that this is not all economically driven, because from what we've talked about so far, we're talking about what we have been taught from way, way, way back in small kid days.
Yeah. I mean, I would want to validate what Rick said, that we have major economic problems here and that
stokes
it's no joke. Yeah. It's no joke that people are struggling to find affordable housing. Right. So I don't want to say that's not an issue, but I would say that the brunt of that is not borne equally across our groups. That's all I would say about it.
I want to point out that the last three questions or comments have really tied together very nicely. They're all about situations where you have what are perceived to be different groups, but then members of those groups realize that they're part of the same group, right? So whether it's different ethnic groups who are experiencing economic problems in Hawaii, whether it's someone who is perceived first as a Haole and then is local and things get better, or whether we're talking about problems with how a target group, a group that's stereotyped, might play into that with their own behavior. And this is something that I think is very important to think about, and that is what kinds of public policies and what kinds of private initiatives get launched, get funded, in order to help people understand where their interests are aligned and help build alliances among different groups of people. And there's been a tendency in the last, I think, couple of decades to say, well, that's over. We're post-racial, we're, you know,
post-feminist, we're post-feminist,
we're post-post-post. But what that actually does is keep us from doing the things that need to be done to keep managing these human problems about differences well.
All right, let's take a few more callers. Going now to Brooke, calling us from the North Shore. Aloha, Brooke. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. Thank you. I just wanted to share my experience. I went to high school on Maui, and I considered that to be pretty diverse. I got to meet a lot of people, but then I didn't really realize it until I came out to school at BYU on the North Shore, where we have over 73 different countries represented, you know, from the students. And so I really did meet people from everywhere, from all around the world, you know, and it was such a blessing and an eye opener for me, because I got to know people as people, not, you know, the girl from Thailand or, you know, the boy from Fiji. It was, you know, my friends. It was people that I cared about, people I got to know. And it actually was a huge blessing for me, too, because I got to meet a wonderful man from Fiji who's now my husband, you know? And so,
well, congratulations.
Feel like,
I mean, the fact that you were able to meet someone who is now your husband, just your point seems to go back to what Linda Krieger said a little earlier, that when you have those personal experiences and you're able to see more of yourself and someone else and just see them as your friends, not just, as you say, the girl from Thailand or the guy from Fiji who might be really cute and one of the reasons why you married him.
I mean, I would have never had that opportunity, thankful to the school, but also if I hadn't really opened myself up to just getting to know people as people and putting that, you know, kind of fear or judgment aside and really just opening myself up.
All right. I want to bring your point back to the conversation here, because she sounds probably under 30, maybe. Is that right, Brooke? I think we might have said goodbye to her already. But at some point, we're always told, well, millennials look at this differently. And they look at all kinds of issues, whether it's sexual orientation or, having more of a sharing economy, looking at how relationships are conducted and race, that we look at that differently if we're millennials. Is that really borne out by some of the research, or is that just another myth we tell ourselves?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that the research across adults shows strong implicit biases, you know, all the way up. It's true that we do sometimes find stronger biases in older people, but it's usually by a small degree. So it's not enough to say, oh yeah, we're all good with the millennials coming through. But there's a small difference, but they still do show strong biases.
All right, we're going to go now to John calling us from Kalihi. If you'd like to be next, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you're on the neighbor islands. Aloha, John. Welcome
Aloha.
To Town Square.
Thank you for taking my call.
A pleasure.
Early in the program, it was mentioned that community groups, I believe in San Francisco in the 80s, sometimes acted to have films shut down that they felt contained objectionable racial or perhaps sexual stereotypes. And we've just had a situation this week where a movie was shut down because unidentified groups believed to include the government of North Korea found that objectionable. My question regarding this topic is, if people draw their conclusions or base their stereotypes of African Americans on movies like Boys in the Hood and Menace to Society, or rap music videos, or artists like a man named Young Thug, at what point do you respect their right as artists to do what they want, and at what point, if any, do you say, wait a minute, these are giving people a false impression of the larger community?
All right, we're going to get you an answer. Thanks very much for your question, John.
John, thank you for that. I think this is a really, really important point. If you look at stereotypes or stereotyping is just a kind of categorization, how people develop a categorical structure to understand the world, and one of the things they categorize is different social groups. Then if you're a member of a stereotype group, it behooves you to pay attention to your behavior. I was active in the lesbian gay rights movement in San Francisco in the 1970s, and I remember being at a community meeting at the Castro Theater a couple of months before the Gay Pride March in 1974, and there was a huge argument about nudity and lewd behavior on floats. And the argument that I and some other people were making was, look, if if you want the lesbian and gay community to be respected by straight people, you can't act this way.
You need to act respectfully.
Yeah, you're just reinforcing stereotypes of the gay community. And so and you know, there's another way of looking at this, and Professor Levinson, you know, talked about it a little earlier about how the artistic expression of marginalized groups has to be understood in historical context. But I think it is also true that we can either contribute to or fight stereotypes.
That is also some of the arguments that were made about some of the cases that we saw play out this summer. Well, why were they resisting arrest? And people were talking about, well, this is what I tell my African-American son, that he needs to do this and this and this, which may be very different from what maybe someone else would tell a son or a daughter. And that those kinds of ways of behaving should be reinforced. Does that make the same argument?
I think it's a really tough question. I mean, part of it is strategic, right? If you're a parent of a child or you're active in a rights organization, you're thinking about what can we do to advance our cause, and sometimes complying with the stereotype and perpetuating it is, you know, not something you want to do for strategic reasons. I think we ought to be careful, though, when we look at outside groups that we're not a part of, and if they express a stereotype consistent message, I don't think that we can always assume to understand where it comes from.
But her point is, well, if you want to be respected, act respectfully and don't feed into a stereotype. Is there any of that that has any validity with what we've seen this summer from the way you look at it?
Well, scientifically, there's validity in it. And, I mean, we know that if somebody acts in a counter-stereotypic manner, so if an African-American whistles classical music down the street, people will not immediately cross the street. They might wait a little bit. So we know those things. But I think we have to be very careful in trying to tell a narrative where we request people to comply with these things in order to avoid reinforcing our stereotypes.
Part of what we began to touch on a week or so ago when you were on the conversation in the morning was that we are seeing slices of these conversations, but not necessarily asking some of the questions like, how many black officers are in predominantly black neighborhoods versus white officers in those same neighborhoods, and vice versa? And why aren't we having a fuller conversation about this and only focusing on these cases, because these cases, as egregious as they are not the only cases that are out there that show this kind of behavior from the police? Any further thoughts about that since we chatted last?
Yeah, I mean, my further thoughts are that we need to be working with police officers. We need to be working with police departments. They ought to be concerned with their perceptions in society. They ought to develop good relationships with people in neighborhoods that feel over-policed. And not
feed into the same type of stereotypes in a different sort of way that Linda Krieger was just talking about.
Right. So there's community policing efforts, right? There are ways to develop relationships, send the same officers to the same areas, have them establish relationships in the community, and that avoids some of the problems that we have seen borne out.
I want to thank both of you for being here. This hour has evaporated. We'll have to do this again sometime soon when you've got some more of that research to talk about. And I want to thank all of you who joined us tonight and who called. Sorry for those of you who we couldn't put through. Next time, we'll try to get you in a little bit earlier. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 is always our number. Maybe you would like to pocket that for future use. Thank you to Professor Linda Krieger for being here, and to Professor Justin Levinson, and to you. I'll see you tomorrow morning right here for The Conversation at 8. Meanwhile, have yourselves a good evening. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha.